Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 27, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's special Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be talking about the recent oral arguments before the Supreme Court in Ziegler v. Abbasi. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Professor Jamil Jaffer, who is an adjunct professor of law and the Director of Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Antonin Scalia Law School. I will turn it over to Professor Jaffer to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Jamil, the floor is yours.
Great, Nate. Thanks for so much for having me. Really appreciate it, and thank you all for joining the call. So today we'll be talking about the case of Ziegler v. Abbasi. It's actually three combined cases involving James Ziegler, the former commissioner of INS, John Ashcroft, the former attorney general, and another case, Hasty v. Abbasi, involving two of the individuals who ran the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. The defendants in this case are senior federal government officials as well as two jailers who were involved in the aftermath of 9/11, and the plaintiffs are Muslim men of both Middle Eastern and South Asian extraction who've brought a claim that they were held unlawfully and under adverse conditions of confinement in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And the claim here is fundamentally a claim for money damages against principally federal officials. And the claim is that these individuals, these federal officials, engaged in a policy of, or entered into a policy of detaining these men unlawfully and in these highly restrictive conditions. Now, what is clear, facts of the case, are that these men were held. They were immigration violators, who some of whom had suspected ties to terrorism, others of whom did not. There were essentially two lists of individuals. There was an INS list and a New York list. The INS list had been vetted down to folks who had specific ties to terrorism, and therefore under existing case law and practice could be held under restrictive conditions of confinement. The New York list, which is a list made by the New York FBI and INS offices, did not differentiate between folks that had ties to terrorism but who did not have ties to terrorism but simply had immigration issues but were being held under this overall rubric of a hold-until-cleared policy, essentially to research these individuals, make sure there were no issues, and then release them over time. These lists were handled differently at times and handled similarly at times. And so at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York, where some of these detainees were held, the individuals were held under fairly restrictive conditions, whereas in the other facility in New York, I believe upstate New York, individuals were held under both some under restrictive and some under non-restrictive conditions. And so the complaint of these individuals is that the policy of merging the two lists, which they claim was a policy, and again, this case is at the pleading stage, so we take the facts as given in the complaint, whether those facts are sufficient to state a claim under the Supreme Court's prior case law in a very similar case, Ashcroft v. Iqbal, where the Supreme Court indicated that you had to have plausible claims against defendants to go forward under this sort of a theory. And so under the Supreme Court's more restrictive holding of what pleadings require, the question is, do these plaintiffs state a claim? And even if they do, do the federal officials get out under qualified immunity because the law was not clearly established as to their conduct? And so those were the issues at stake before the Supreme Court. And one larger meta issue I should mention, which is, can you have a Bivens damages remedy in a case like this involving, as the government put it, sensitive national security and immigration policy decisions in the immediate aftermath of a terrorist attack? And a Bivens damages remedies are a judge-made, a judiciary-made remedy that allows damages against federal officials, money damages against federal officials, for constitutional violations. And as folks on the call probably know, as for damages against state officials for constitutional violations, there's a federal statute, 1983, which permits money damages against state officials. However, on the federal side, the damages remedy is a remedy created by the courts to allow for money damages. In theory, the idea being behind these money damages being that you can deter bad conduct going forward if, in fact, the law is clearly established and a reasonable federal official would have known that their conduct would violate such law, and therefore you can go forward on the theory. Now, again, the case important for a variety of reasons, but really important because the question is: will there be a heightened pleading standard or a different view on pleadings going forward in terms of plausibility, and will this case set new law as Iqbal did and tighten the law down on pleadings? Second, will Bivens damages be allowed for high-level policy decisions made by senior decision-makers in the government? And if so, will that chill policymaking in the future going forward by senior-level officials because of the availability of money damages? You know, and interestingly, this case, you know, these events took place in the immediate aftermath, the immediate months after 9/11. It's now nearly 15 years later, more than 15 years later. And, of course, here we are still debating, approximately 15 years later, still debating these cases. And so, you know, a real potential chilling effect in long-term litigation costs and challenges for these defendants. And then finally, you know, the question whether these individuals, in fact, should enjoy qualified immunity because they could not have known at the time that this policy decision, as implemented in terms of restrictive conditions at the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York, would then have been levied against people they didn't necessarily know were on these lists. Again, we have to take the facts as granted in the complaint. And then ultimately, whether they would have known that those actions and the restrictive conditions of confinement, which would have otherwise been lawful as against the detainees individually suspected of terrorism, whether that in fact subjects individuals to liability or at least allow the case to go forward past the pleading stages and escapes and gets past qualified immunity to allow these defendants to be held liable. So that was the stage we faced. That was where we stood. The decision below allowed the claim to go forward, and so the question before the court was would it reverse the lower court? And what was interesting about that oral argument was that the court was quite shorthanded. Obviously, as everyone knows, with the unfortunate passing of Justice Scalia, the court is down one member as it stands, with 8 members on the court now. We hear that apparently in the next week or so, the president will announce his nominee to replace Justice Scalia on the court. But notwithstanding that, in the confirmation process, the court is shorthanded as it stands. And in this case in particular, oral argument was even more shorthanded because two of the justices, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, were both recused from the case, ostensibly because they had some involvement in the matter or related matters in their prior time in government. So the court in this case at oral argument down to 6 members from the 8 that are currently sitting on the court. And you know, for the plaintiffs in this case, the Muslim males, you know, what they would need, if you assume the court broke along what people believe are the ideological lines on the court, they would need to, even if they had gotten, if they were able to get Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, they'd still, in order to get a tie and to sustain the lower court's decision, they'd still need one of Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Kennedy, or Justice Alito. So I think the if you were a handicapper looking at this court, you were looking at some potentially tough sledding for the plaintiffs, even though in a typical scenario, all they would need to do is to get to a tie, and with Justices Sotomayor and Kagan on the sidelines, it made that a little more challenging for them to sustain the ruling of the lower court. So off we go to arguments, and you know the case sort of began with the Solicitor General or the Assistant Solicitor General arguing, look, this is just like Iqbal. You all, the justices, have seen this case before. You've already said the plaintiffs can't state a claim. Their claims aren't specific enough. They're not detailed enough. And there's a plausible basis for there to have been a obvious non-invidious, that is, non-discriminatory basis for the decisions made by the defendants, that they were not motivated by racial or religious animus. But in fact, what they were concerned about was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, when this policy was instituted in October of 2001, you know, the concern was the mistaken release of an individual who could have had terrorist ties, and that they were doing everything they could to guard against that. So yes, while it's true, individuals who did not have suspected ties to terrorism were detained, and some of them admittedly were detained under restrictive conditions at the MDC in New York. The question is, you know, was that problematic given, and can you, is there a plausible claim to be made that these high level Justice Department and INS officials and jailers acted with some sort of racial or religious animus, is there an obvious and alternative explanation that doesn't comport with the facts alleged in the complaint that would prevent the claim from going forward because the allegations aren't specific and sufficient enough to actually state a claim? So, to be fair, I think that on that ground alone, there was some suspicion by the justices. There was a skepticism, I think, of the plaintiff's claims. Interestingly, the attorney. For the plaintiffs, the attorney for the Muslim males, provided a very capable argument, and you know it's worth noting that she actually her great grandparents were actually Julius and Ethel Rosenberg who were ultimately executed for spying in a series of famous cases that came before the court. But she gave a very impassioned argument and a very credible argument, I think, for the plaintiffs. But I think ultimately, given the argument the way it went, there was a lot of skepticism about the claim. In particular, there was skepticism, I think, on the question whether the Bivens remedy, this judge-made remedy, which the court has repeatedly said is to be very carefully cabined, very carefully and not extended beyond its circumstances, except in rare circumstances where it's absolutely necessary to ensure proper conduct by federal officials and in particular, people who either are involved in federal law enforcement activities or federal imprisonment activities. I think she faced a very stiff uphill battle there, making that claim that Bivens ought to be extended to this national security and immigration context, particularly with high level policy decisions. Now, Ms. Mirapol made a strong argument, I think, that in fact, you know, this isn't really about national security and immigration policy. What was really going on here was that these defendants were engaged in a policy to ensure these people were mistreated and were held under very restrictive conditions because that was where they were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and that was their view. But at the end of the day, I think that in fact courts had previously held that you could impose Bivens remedies on federal officials for conditions of confinement, and that simply putting this in a national security context didn't change things, or putting this in a policy context didn't change things. At the end of the day, if the result is restrictive conditions of confinement, that's an available Bivens claim. So there's nothing new, no extension of Bivens needed here. But it seems, at least at oral argument from the recordings, that the court was skeptical of that claim, and that there were other remedies available to these defendants. That in fact the defense didn't only need to have money damage; that was their only way of recompense for this for these alleged constitutional violations. That in fact they could have sought habeas relief, and some in fact did seek habeas relief and were released from prison ultimately. As a result of their habeas petitions. And so I think an uphill battle for the plaintiffs at the end of the day, but a very interesting case, an important case, one that I think will guide future courts generally in the case of what you need to do in terms of pleadings and obviousness and viability of claims going forward. And then in the more specific context of national security and immigration cases, the question of the Bivens remedy being extended and the other related questions we talked about. So, with that, I won't bore you with any more talking from me. I would love to take audience questions or questions from the folks at the Society if there are questions. I'd love to take them.
Okay, very good, Professor. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One quick announcement regarding a recently scheduled teleform. Our next teleform conference call is set for this Monday, the 30th, at 10 a.m. That call will focus on the Obama administration's abstention from the United Nations Security Council vote on Resolution 2334. That call will feature Professor Bernard Avishai, who is an adjunct professor of business at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and Professor Ord Kitri, who is a senior fellow, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, as well as Professor Eugene Kontrovich, who is a professor of law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Again, if you would like to join the queue is wide open. Please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Jamil, one of the questions I had in just looking at the case, under this policy, I'm sure, how many individuals are we talking about? Do you have a...
It's a great... The plaintiffs in this case, there's a handful of them. Actual individuals involved, I've got to go back and look. I know there were... Of the people that were detained, there were sort of, you know, hundreds of thousands. There were a large number of individuals detained. How many were actually held under restrictive conditions of confinement, though, I think it's a fairly small number, particularly ones who were held at the MDC under restrictive conditions of confinement who did not have terrorist ties, right? So sort of the New York list individuals, the ones on the New York list without terrorist ties who were then held at the MDC, because the bulk of the New York list plaintiffs were actually plaintiffs, were held at, who could have been plaintiffs, detainees were held at this other facility in New York, in upstate New York. And as a result, we're talking about a fairly small category of folks. I don't actually know the exact number.
Okay. And roughly, I mean, how long were these individuals held under this hold to clear policy?
Yeah, so some, you know, just for a few weeks, months, but some actually held for a fairly long period, more than 7-8 months. And so, you know, there is a concern, and actually this came up in oral argument, you know, of whether, you know, after the government sort of realized that some of these people might not have suspected connections to terrorism, does that decision to continue to detain them indicate some sort of racial or religious animus that could constitute a basis for a violation of constitutional right and therefore a basis for money damages? And I think the government's position was, look, you know, even if we determine that these specific individuals may not have been suspected at the time of ties to terrorism, we've got them on immigration violations, and it's worth ensuring post 9/11 in the immediate aftermath, even 6, 7, 8 months later. You have to remember, I mean, people, it's easy to forget that era, but at that time there was a real belief, an honestly held belief in the U.S. government as well as in the public, that further attacks were coming, and that in fact a strong posture leading forward was critical to preventing those attacks or minimizing their effect. And so even 7-8 months later, it's not surprising to hear the U.S. government argue the point and make the case that in fact they were still deeply concerned about accidentally releasing somebody who had terrorist ties and might conduct an attack in the United States.
Okay, very good. Currently, our lines are still open, wide open for an audience question. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign.
Well, apparently I haven't said anything controversial enough to elicit questions.
Oh, well.
You spoke too soon. We have our first caller of the day. Let's go to that question right now.
Hi, this is Sancho, a society member from Vancouver. There was some discussion about lack of alternative remedies, and I think counsel mentioned that when a defendant managed to, you know, get the proper complaint filed, the government would just kind of speed up the resolution of their case, not let that go to judicial decision, and either move them to another facility or get them out of the detention altogether. What do you think of that kind of as applied lack of alternative remedy argument?
Well, I guess if the goal of the defendant or the detainee in this case is to get out of jail, right, and they're filing a habeas remedy, and that the filing of that habeas remedy causes the government to accelerate the clearance of that individual or to move that individual to a less restrictive facility, well, then it strikes me that the goal was achieved, and that it would have been worse for the government to not speed it up, right, because they would have been under the conditions of confinement they didn't like or confinement at all for a longer period. So if the goal is to get out, you know, by hook or by crook, and if you're waiting for a judge's decision and then an appeal and an appeal and an appeal, it seems to me better the government, you know, speeds it up and gets it done. Now, in an ideal world, you don't want to have the filing of an habeas necessary to trigger the government to move faster. The government should move as quickly as possible, clear as many people as possible, move them out. But again, understanding the and recalling back to those circumstances in that era, you know, the government was working very hard not to detain people forever and a day, although I think that is sort of the popular imagination about what was going on. The real truth was the government was doing its best to get to the individuals that were there, identify them, determine what their connection to terrorism was, and release them if there was no connection, but to be sure that, in fact, there was no connection. At least this, I think, is the argument that the government did make, in fact, at the Supreme Court. Well, the government was not sitting there trying to hold people forever. They were trying to ensure that they were not accidentally releasing individuals with ties to terrorism. Now, in an ideal world, they would not have needed that for speed, and they would the filing of habeas, and moreover, they would not have held people under restrictive conditions of confinement who didn't have ties to terrorism. That's not how it turned out, and obviously not an ideal situation, not an ideal situation for the detainees, not an ideal situation for the government, but there we stood, and the question is now, after that fact, was there a policy and practice within the administration at the senior most levels of creating a policy to, in fact, impose restrictive conditions on confinement on people because of their religion or race? And that, I think, is the ultimate real challenge, I think, for the plaintiffs here, is sort of proving that up or alleging enough facts sufficient to prove that beyond sort of the plausibility requirements of Iqbal.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Currently, the queue is wide open. If you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign.
We could start humming the theme song to Jeopardy. See if that elicits people to join the queue.
Doesn't look like we have any further questions. Are there any additional remarks? Perhaps, I mean, would you like to? It sounded like you were going to maybe hazard a guess as to what the final ruling might be based on oral arguments, or anything else you'd like to add to the discussion. Oh, wait.
Well, I mean, you know,
let me interrupt. Well, I mean, we do have another audience question.
Ah, terrific.
Thank you. I could wonder if you could tell us what the restrictive conditions of confinement actually consisted of, and who has to, under what authority are those even allowed?
Yeah, so great question. Trying to look through my paperwork here real quick. I'm going to do this off memory, so if I get this wrong and there are folks who are involved in the case and I get this wrong, please jump in and correct me because I'm going to do this from memory. My recollection, if I recall correctly, was there were a couple of things going on here that were a challenge. Number one was the restrictive conditions of confinement as a general matter were essentially solitary. They were put in solitary and held incommunicado in what's known as the SHU, the special housing unit, or under what it would amount to in the federal system, administrative maximum conditions. So essentially isolated from other prisoners, including at rec time and the like. And so as I understand it, again, people should correct me if I have that wrong, but that's what I recall is the general conditions of confinement complaint. Beyond that, particularly with respect to the federal jailers, the jailers at the Metropolitan Detention Center, there were lower level officers and the like who are alleged to have engaged in more aggressive activities, sort of the kind of beating or abusive behavior towards the detainees. And there is an effort. There was an effort in the case to hold at least the Metropolitan Center Detention Center defendants liable for those policies and practices that took place under their time and in leadership of that facility, also. And so, the larger claim is the claim about the restrictive conditions being the SHU, the special housing unit, and the sort of solitary confinement type issues. It's fair to say are. Solitary confinement is, as I understand it, I've never been in it myself, but it's, as I understand it, is not a pleasant thing.
I have one other question, if I may.
Sure.
Why would a habeas not have been filed straight away?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that some of these individuals, this is, again, immediate aftermath of 9/11, and there were some claims made that some of these individuals didn't have access to attorneys, were restricted in what the communication with their attorneys and the like. And some habeas claims were filed right at the outset or maybe within short periods of time. Some of these individuals were indigent. It took a little while to get their attorneys and get them up to speed and get the habeas things filed. But so some did, and in fact some did ultimately get out either. I think as the earlier caller mentioned, I'm not sure if any of them got out actually on actual habeas grants. I think maybe one or two may have. but the bulk of them got out either while their habeas cases were proceeding, whether you believe because the government sped it up or because, you know, the normal course just ran. But a lot of these individuals were released over time. It is worth noting, as I mentioned earlier, that the number of individuals were held for quite a long period. So, you know, it's not that these claims are illegitimate or ill-founded, you know, in the sense of people were held under restricted conditions for long periods. The question is, can you hold the Attorney General of the United States, the head of the INS, and other senior officials, I think the director of the FBI was also involved, liable for a policy that resulted in these conditions, even though, you know, are your allegations sufficient to show that they intentionally did this out of racial and religious animus? And that, I think, is just an uphill battle, not to mention the Bivens uphill battle, which is, I think, almost post-Iqbal, the pleading and the Bivens battles are very hard to climb, I think.
One other thing, if there's nobody else on there, okay, ask another thing?
Yeah, I need Nate. Is that fine?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Is there any prejudice against a person who has a remedy that is not used and therefore suffers consequences that might have been mitigated had they used that remedy?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. That's a tough one. Speaking off the cuff and sort of first principles, I mean, if you have an available remedy and you don't employ it, and then sort of bad things happen to you, does that immunize the people who did those bad things? Almost certainly not. But if you have alternative remedies and don't employ them, could it be a basis for saying, well, you know, you had your chance and didn't take your shot? Could be, you know. I don't think it should be. It should be. Again, I'm just speaking off the cuff, just off the top of my head, but I don't know the actual. I don't have a legal answer. Maybe I should just stop there and instead of spouting off my generalized policy views.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we spark any more questions, Nate?
At this point, not, but let's give one more reminder. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. But I think I cut you off with the last caller who was asking, you know, if you had any, you know, scorecard predictions based on oral argument or any further comments you wanted to add with regard to oral argument or the case in general.
No, I mean, I think you know, I mean, look, I mean, I think we've successfully put everybody on the phone to sleep, so nobody's asking questions. I think you know, it's always hard. You should always be loath, I think, to predict where the Supreme Court's going to end up on anything, because you know, we obviously saw people make predictions with respect to this election, and that did not work out so well for people. The court even perhaps more fickle than the American electorate in terms of making predictions. So I'm not sure I want to hazard a guess, but I guess what I would say is I do think that the defendants have an uphill battle, not really because of the ideological makeup of the court, which some people have suggested, but more and the fact that Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were not on the bench for the oral argument, but more actually because post-Iqbal, having allegations of this variety, and at the end of the day, these are almost the same allegations as Iqbal. I do think the assistant to the SG, Ian Gershgorn, who argued this case, was right. I think it's very hard to make the case that these defendants could get past the bar of Iqbal. Now, the court did grant, so, you know, but it granted based on a Second Circuit allowing the claims to go forward. So, you know, they could be granted in reverse. So Iqbal, I think, is a challenge. And then the extension of Bivens, it is a non-trivial, particularly, you know, with a largely skeptical court to extend Bivens, particularly in this very narrow, focused context of high-level decision-making officials, a big picture, 80,000 foot, say, policy call, and the facts of the aftermath of 9/11 and the conditions that pertained at that point. So when you combine those sort of things, and actually, I thought the government did a very smart job by saying, really, this case is not about Bivens generally extending Bivens. It's about extending Bivens to senior government officials for policy decisions right after 9/11. It's about that one little thing, and in that narrow little case, you really shouldn't extend Bivens. And I think that's a very hard argument to get past. So I think even though Ms. Mirapol did a very good job at oral argument, and she had a very, you know, very credible argument, I think the best she could have done, both on the briefs and on oral argument, I think at the end of the day, she probably was facing an uphill battle as it was. And then if you add in the fact of the court's makeup at the time, I think it will be a real challenge. But again, never predict anything. You know, I think people predict the election. People predict Supreme Court cases all the time, often get it wrong. So that's, I think, where I'll leave it.
Understood. We just like to bring our experts on and get them down for the record and then bring them back.
Exactly.
To work against the record. Well, actually, we're lucky to have another caller question, so let's go to that question right now.
All right.
Good afternoon. This is Roger Candelaria. I appreciate a very excellent presentation, and I think maybe part of the hesitation some of us have about asking questions is either it's not our area of expertise or we don't know how we would apply it in other cases. So my question goes to this, to a hypothetical, give you another chance to make a prediction. Let's assume that two or three very conservative / libertarian Supreme Court justices are appointed in the next few years. Where do you see Bevin's case going, and how it might it be applicable in the Bevin's doctrine? How might it be applicable in other areas of the law, somewhat removed from this terrorism suspect area?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Again, dangerous to guess in this space, particularly dangerous, I think, to guess at a time when, you know, we're probably what looks like, if you believe the president's Twitter account, we are, you know, 5 days or 7 days away from a 6 days away from an announcement of a new nominee to the Supreme Court. I think dangerous to guess. But I guess what I would say is this. I actually think that, and again, this is assuming you assume, and I think it's not fair to assume that a justice will, that justices generally vote their ideology, because I really think justices ought and should and do vote the law in these cases and try to apply the law as best they can. Now, different people have different views about what the law is and what the law ought to be in terms of how the Supreme Court and Supreme Court justices view their role, certainly. But I think as a general matter, nobody's trying to vote their ideology. And so, but let's assume people break along their ideological, that their legal analysis ultimately aligns with where their ideology is, and you believe there's a conservative. I think that a conservative and a libertarian are going to come out potentially different ways on this, right? At least from the perspective that I think a libertarian is more likely, at least on criminal law issues, more likely to look with some favor on doctrines that allow recompense for constitutional violations that go to liberty, whether it's detention or conditions of confinement or the like. Now, would a libertarian justice really permit money damages? Maybe, maybe not, right? But they certainly are going to be more inclined if you believe, again, this is all caveated with the if you believe somebody votes their ideology, which, I don't think people do or ought to do. But if they do, then you could see that, potentially libertarian justice trying to find room for that, whereas a conservative justice, sort of a classical law and order conservative justice, might feel differently and be less inclined to extend the remedy. So I think that's so I'm not sure the two are the same. And then, you know, when you think about who the president might appoint and who his nominees might be, I think you have no real way of knowing. And I think actually nominees ought not speak on these questions. I think nominees, what they ought to do is to talk about their judicial philosophy, what they think the role of a judge ought be. And then, you know, a lot of these nominees, in fact, the ones that at least we're looking at here on the short list, all appear to have a long history on the bench and all have a record that you can look at and go read their cases and see where, you know, at least as appellate or state court judges, they've come out on these issues and or related issues or their judicial philosophy generally. So I think that's probably the best indication, both a nominee's statements in their work that they've done. And here in most cases of all the people on the Trump 21 list, I think all of them have significant judicial experience, with the exception of maybe one or two. And so they all have records you can look at and see what the way they look at cases. Other questions?
I'll issue a final call for questions. Please enter star or the pound sign on your telephone. Jamil, looks like we have covered it.
Great.
Again, anything further you'd like to add?
No, I think just thanks to everybody for joining the call, and thanks to the Federal Society and to you, Nate, for hosting this call. I really appreciate it. It's been, as always, a fun time, and I appreciate the questions. They're good, tough questions, at least one that I had to sort of punt on, because it's hard to make real predictions on that front. But appreciate everyone taking the time to be on this call and to engage on these issues. These issues are important both as a matter of law and as a matter of sort of, you know, understanding where the nation is on some of these hard questions. You know, we remain in a time of high threat to the nation, both from terrorism And, you know, just the national security situation the country faces is a tough one. And so I anticipate we will see more situations like this, hopefully not coming out of mass casualty attacks, but I anticipate we'll see more litigation about national security issues, whether it's surveillance or counterterrorism policy or the like, here in the next few years. And so I encourage folks who are on the call and folks who have friends who are not on the call to continue to discuss and debate these issues and to join us in the Federal Society for more of these teleforums and get your friends on and listen in, because we're happy to hear from you and to get your thoughts and debate these issues with all comers.
Very good, and we look forward to having you again soon. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Professor Jamil Jaffer for speaking with us today. We welcome listener feedback at email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.